Good morning. My name is Quinn Leach, Q-U-I-N-N-L-E-I-T-C-H. And I'm interviewing retired Commander Lloyd Barnes, L-L-O-Y-D-B-A-R-N-E-S. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you please state your full name and rank, please?
Yes, I'm Commander Lloyd William Barnes, and I'm retired commander from the Canadian Navy.
Perfect. And when, where, and why did you join the Royal Canadian Navy?
I joined the Royal Canadian Navy in September 1959. I enlisted at HMCS York in Toronto. I did my officer selection down in Centralia in, near London. And I entered Royal Military College in September 1959, where I was enrolled in the Royal Canadian Navy. When I finished RMC, I did sub-lieutenant's courses at Stadacona in Halifax, and then I came out to the West Coast to serve in our West Coast Prestonian class frigates, where I obtained my bridge watchkeeping certificate and learned the ropes, so to speak, about navigation, operations, weapons, and everything, and I served there until 1966 when I entered the submarine service. Why I became a submariner? Well, during my time in frigates, we did a lot of operations with HMCS Grills and other submarines, and I admired their efficiency, how they always seemed to win the war, so to speak, when we were doing exercises. But moreover, they were always where they were supposed to be on time, and they seemed to conduct their operations very efficiently. And at times when I was the operations officer of a frigate, I used to have to go over to the submarine to discuss forthcoming operations. I was impressed by the casual efficiency of the submariner. There was no pomp and ceremony or anything, but they sure as hell knew what they were doing. And I, based on that, I wouldn't mind joining this group. I went on my initial submarine training in April 1966 with the Royal Navy, completed my basic officer submarine qualifying course, and I took my wife and children over to England at the same time. And then I went to sea in a Royal Navy submarine, HMS Opossum, where that later that fall I qualified in submarines. I stayed with the Opossum until April 1967. And while I was there, I did the Royal Naval Officers sonar course, one of the first courses that the Royal Navy did in submarine sonar officers. And then I came back to Canada in April 1967. In fact, I arrived back in Canada the morning after the Toronto Maple Leafs last won the Stanley Cup. I didn't even know they were in the playoffs. But I turned on the radio and I found out my hockey team had won. So then I then made my way with my family out to Halifax, where I joined HMCS Ojibwe, and I was informed that I would be the supply officer and the electrical officer of the Ojibwe. And they asked me also to complete a short qualifying course for Canadian submarines, which I successfully did. I then served in Ojibwe as the supply officer, electrical officer. Then I was moved up as the engineering officer, and I did that job for a year. And then I then took over the job as the operations officer. And I was with Ojibwe when she went into her first refit in August of 1968. And I was with Ojibwe for most of her first refit. But in January 1970, they decided I should go back to sea again. I wasn't with Ojibwe when she came out refit. I was sent down to the Caribbean to join Okanagan and take over the job as engineering officer because their engineering officer had become ill. And I then served in Okanagan as engineering officer until July of 1971 when two things happened. I was selected for promotion to lieutenant commander and posted as the executive officer, which is second in command of HMCS Rainbow on the West Coast. I came out to Rainbow and took over as executive officer, and I was a bit leery of what this job might entail because I'd never served in that class of submarine. But I quickly learned that a submarine was a submarine, and I had the full support of the Rainbow's crew, and I learned the essential parts of that submarine so that I was quite able to do my job as executive officer. After being XO for a year and a half, I was selected to go to the UK to do my submarine commanding officer's qualifying course, known as Perisher. I did my Perisher from April to July of 1973 and successfully passed it. And then came back and took command of Rainbow. And I was the commanding officer of Rainbow from August 1973 until the submarine decommissioned on December 31st, 1974, when I was immediately posted as the captain of HMCS Ojibwe, an Oberon class on the East Coast. I went out to Ojibwe, which was in refit. We completed the refit. I took it over to the UK for workups and then brought the submarine back to Canada and then completed almost another year as commanding officer. And in 1976, I guess about March 76, I was relieved as commanding officer of Ojibwe, and I took over as commanding officer of HMCS Onondaga, which was in refit at the time, and I was captain of Onondaga until I was selected to go to Staff College in August 1976. And that was the last time I went to sea in a submarine as a member of a crew.
Right on. And we'll get into, what was your family's initial thoughts about yourself serving on a submarine?
My wife, completely in favor of it. She knew that's what I wanted to do. She never had any apprehensions about safety or anything in a submarine. She supported me 100%, and my sons loved it. During my time in submarines, I was able to, my wife went to sea for a few day trips, which she thoroughly enjoyed. And while I was captain of Rainbow, I was able to take each one of my sons to sea for a week submarine experience.
Oh, cool.
There was only one time submarine service ever gave her a little bit of a scare. And that was in the spring of 1968 when I was serving with Ojibwe. We were doing an exercise called Meat Play off of the East Coast when one of the surface ships spotted a red flare, which is an indication of a submarine in distress, but there was no submarine. And so the operational authority ordered all submarines to surface and the exercise to be suspended. All submarines surfaced except Ojibwe, and the red flare was from in the area where they thought Ojibwe might be. We had, just before the warning, copied our radio broadcast and went deep, so we didn't come back up to periscope depth for about another 8 hours. So by this time the world was sort of in a panic. In fact, they had started the procedure for looking for a lost submarine. Unfortunately, the word got out to a local radio station who put the news on the radio that the submarine Ojibwe was missing.
Oh, no.
My wife heard that report and was very, very concerned, obviously. And so the lesson from that is that newspapers and media should not take any reports on any sort of missing accidents from sources like somebody phoning in trying to win the $10 award for the story of the week, that they should base their reports on official reports mm-hmm. given out by the armed forces.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So we'll go into, I'll talk a little about the, if you can explain a little more in detail on your experiences with the Submarine Commanding Office Qualifying Course or the Perisher.
Right, well, when one does Perisher, one has to think about it for several years beforehand because you're told about it right from the beginning of your submarine career and you start your preparation. In order to go on Perisher, you have to have passed a level of command exams, which the Canadian Navy has. I did that, and I also passed my command board, which allowed me, I was qualified to command a surface ship before I was qualified to command a submarine. And Canadian Navy actually prepared our officers quite well because we tended to give our executive officers and other junior officers more experience in handling submarines, ship handling and that, than other navies. Most other navies, the captain does all that, and the executive officer gets the odd try, whereas in the Canadian Navy, we trained our junior officers right from the beginning how to handle a submarine, take it to sea and bring it back in port.
Mm-hmm.
So I was quite well prepared in that respect. I had a great background in navigation from my time in frigates, and I had passed all my command exams and operations and everything, so I was really quite well prepared. Yet you're still apprehensive because you know the people who have gone before you,
mm-hmm.
and you know those who have passed, and you also know those who have failed, and you know that the Royal Navy has approximately a 30-35% failure rate mm-hmm. on this course, and you know that if you fail, that's the end of your seagoing submarine career.
Mm-hmm.
So you're very apprehensive. I went over, started my course. It was very interesting the way I did my course. I was with what was called the NATO Perisher.
Okay.
And on my course, there was an Australian who wasn't part of NATO, but he was still an Australian officer on my course. There was a Portuguese officer, a German officer, a Dutch officer, a Norwegian, and a Canadian. There were six of us mm-hmm. on that course. And then on the other side, there was another Perisher running at the same time, which had five Royal Navy officers and one Dutch officer.
Okay.
So I was with the what was called the NATO Perisher. The course starts with getting to know each other.
Okay.
You spend about 2 weeks at we spent about 2 weeks at HMS Dolphin, which was a submarine school in Gosport near Portsmouth in Hampshire. And we did interesting things, like we visited training establishments, mm-hmm. we visited people who manufactured some submarine equipment, and we had courses in the very basics of submarine command and that type of thing. And that was really what I call a get-to-know-each-other
mm-hmm.
days, and it was fun. You know, we spent a lot of time in pubs and that type of thing. And then we had a week off. And at the time, I took my wife and three children over to England when I did my course because she's from England and her parents were living up in Lancashire.
Okay.
So she had gone up to Blackpool,
mm-hmm.
had rented a small apartment there, and I was able to go up there and we lived there. In fact, we even bought a car while we were there so that we could drive around. Anyway, so then we come back. And the next phase of the course was the shore phase where we were in a attack teacher, teaching us the basics of how to do submarine attack and handle the periscope. But that's all done under very controlled conditions because mm-hmm. you're in a trainer as opposed to being at sea. And we did ours at the submarine attack teacher in Faslane, Scotland. And we also did 1 week over in the Isle of Rothesay, which is in the the Clyde area.
Okay.
And while in Rothsay, we took that little old car that we had bought, and we drove it all the way from Blackpool up to Scotland, and took it on the ferry over to Rothsay, and my wife was able to enjoy a week there with the children.
Oh, nice.
It was on that trip that I taught my children a little bit of engineering. The car was an old car, and it just stopped running. So I went and lifted the hood and mm-hmm. noted that there was that the gas line had a little hole in it, mm-hmm. a break in it. So I asked one of the children to go get some bubble gum. And he went and got some bubble gum, and I said, "All right, chew it." And he chewed it, and I then took it and wrapped it around the hole. And we started the car. And my children still remember that story of how Dad got the car going.
Bubble gum.
Anyway, it was good enough till we got to a local garage where they could fix the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was that basic part of the course. It was fun, and mm-hmm. at the end of that phase, you're ready to go to sea, but you're still not, you know, it's still going to be different, because it's mm-hmm. much different being in an actual submarine than doing it in a trainer. The next phase was a 5-week phase, which took place in the Clyde, which is an area. The Clyde is the big river, the Firth of Clyde leading up to Glasgow. And we actually, for the week, we would stay at a small hotel in Broddick Bay in the Isle of Arran. And the course took place in May, so there was early sunrise and late sunsets. So we'd get up about 5 in the morning, have a quick juice and bowl of cereal or something at the hotel, get on board a little boat which would take us out to the submarine mm-hmm. at about 5:30 in the morning. We'd sail. By 7:30 we were dived out in the Clyde, and we'd start our work, and it involved attacking surface ships
okay.
all day long. And you'd rotate your, there were 6 of us, you'd rotate through as one attack you would be working on the plot.
Okay.
Another attack, you'd be working on the torpedo fire control system.
Sure.
Another one, you'd be working on the fire control calculator, which mm-hmm. would have a solution. Another attack, you'd be the executive officer. Another attack, you'd be the captain. And that was the one where you were really being assessed. So you'd rotate through these positions, and during a day, you would probably end up as doing at least 12 attacks during the day.
Wow.
And you'd complete sometime about 6-7 in the evening. You'd go to the wardroom where you'd sit down with a guy named Teacher. Mm-hmm. We called him Teacher, but he was an instructor. And he would then go over the lessons to be learned for the day, at the same time pouring out scotch. Have a sip. And we'd sail back into port, and we'd then go back to the hotel and then do the rehash at the bar of the hotel, probably getting to bed sometime around between 11 and midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was roomed with the Portuguese officer,
okay.
Arthur, who was not a very confident chap.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember one night after we had turned in, and I just dozing off to sleep, and Arthur says, "Lloyd." I says, "Yes, Arthur." He says, "Do you think I passed this course?" I says, "I don't know, Arthur. Just keep plugging." And I'll tell you a little bit about Arthur later mm-hmm. on. Anyway, the course started. Week 1, there was 1 target. Week 2, there was 2 targets.
Mm-hmm.
Week 3, there was 3 targets. Week 4, there was 4 targets.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you went beyond that, it didn't matter how many targets you had. Only so many ships can get close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the game was set up so that you couldn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Because Teacher was always directing the ships to the exact position of the submarine.
Oh.
And they had come zinging right in on you, and as soon as they saw the periscope, they would steer towards you mm-hmm. with the idea of what's called putting you deep. So what you'd do, you'd be on the periscope, and you would be looking around, and you had to, first of all, keep clear of all the little fishing boats in the area.
Okay.
Secondly, maneuver the submarine into a position where you can attack, successfully deliver an attack. And third, make sure that if the submarine got within what was called your go-deep circle,
sure,
you had gone deep in time. And that you didn't stay deep too long, that you came up to back up to periscope depth as soon as you could. So for the first week with one target, it might seem simple, but actually one and two targets were the most difficult times for me, because I was learning it. By the time we got to three or four targets, it didn't matter. It'd bring on the whole Royal Navy unhappy, because you got to know how to time things. You had about three stopwatches where you were timing different ships, and then you would, when you took a setup on a ship, you would then convert the distance he was away from you, which you use by trigonometry, measuring the angle of an object on his hull from the waterline. You'd turn distance into time, and the time that you had was based on his maximum speed and your speed that you would use to go deep. And then you had to come up with those answers. If you put a setup, you say bearing that, range that, the guy would say 20 minutes. And then you would say put me 30 port, which was your angle on his bow, down periscope. As soon as the periscope was going down, you'd have to give the teacher his distance and the time he had within a second. Your mental arithmetic had to be that quick. So it was very demanding. My personal experience was for week one or two, I thought things were not going too well for Lloyd Barnes. At the end of week two, my wife, who was in Blackpool, we had the weekend back in Faslane. She came up to visit me, and we spent the night at couple nights at the Royal Northern Yacht Club, which was one of these old Scottish hotels, really. And I was able to just completely forget about the course. And my wife and I did a little bit of sightseeing around the town. She got to meet all the rest of my parisher friends. I came over to the mess one evening, and we had a really good, fun evening. And then I put her on the train, I think, on a Sunday evening to go back to Blackpool. Went back when I went to sea on Monday morning. Piece of cake.
Wow.
I had no trouble for the rest of that phase of the course. It seemed that everything seemed to fall in place. And I don't know why that happened, but it did. Yeah. And a funny thing happened at the hotel. We were at the officer's mess, and we then took a taxi back to the hotel. And unlike Canadian hotels where you just walk in the door and up to your room, no, you had to have what was called a latch key to get into the front door, and we didn't. I just had the key to my room. When we got back to the hotel about midnight, it was all dark, black, and we tried to open the front door. It was locked. So we rapped on the front door. Finally, this lady came down in a nightgown. She came down. She said, yes. And says, would you let us in? Our room's upstairs. She let us in. I says, well, thank you. She says, well, she says, I'm just one of the guests here. They were all the hotel. Where to be seen? Anyway, we went to see. I passed that phase of my course. As I said, the NATO... I was on the NATO phase. We didn't lose anybody.
Hello.
The Royal Navy phase lost the Dutchman and two Royal Navy officers, so they were down to three people. So they had to take one person from the NATO and put them onto the Royal Navy course to balance the courses. So they took me. And to this day, I don't know whether they took me because I was the guy who was really doing well on the course, or... was I the guy that was borderline and they wanted a different teacher, because the more senior teacher was in charge of the Royal Navy course, to have a good look at me? And I don't know the answer to that question, nor do I want to. Anyway, we had a couple more weeks alongside where we discussed tactical operations at sea and that type of thing. Spent some time in the trainer, and then we went to sea for a week in a Royal Navy submarine for the thing known as the cockfight, where you went to sea and you this submarine was actually participating in an exercise, and you got to do operational type exercises, and every guy on the course was assigned a different task, and you had to prepare it, and then basically you were put in command of the submarine for a period of 12 hours. Well, you under supervision, obviously, while you conducted that phase of the exercise. And if you failed, they didn't wait to the end of the course to take you. They just called you into the wardroom. Teacher said you failed, and this is why. The submarine surfaced, and a helicopter came out and picked you off.
Wow.
One of the Royal Navy officers who was on my course, he was doing an exercise, and one of the main things they're trying to teach you during Perisher is submarine safety, as well as how to be a commanding officer and how to conduct attacks. But submarine safety is probably the number one thing they teach you in peacetime. Well, he was doing this exercise, and we were down about 400 feet, and he was trying to evade some surface ships.
Mm-hmm.
So he went, put the submarine in batteries in series, which is the fastest the submarine will go.
Mm-hmm.
But it drains the battery quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The faster you go, the less time you can run.
Right.
So he was running batteries in full ahead batteries in series for quite a while. When the call came from the motor room, the people in charge of the motor saying, "Sir, you'll have to slow down. We're running out of battery capacity." He didn't. The electrical officer came to him and said, "Duty captain, you're running out of battery capacity. You'll have to slow down." He didn't. The engineering officer of the submarine came to him and said, "You're running out of battery capacity. You'll have to slow down." He didn't. The next thing, his teacher came into the control room and said, "I've got the submarine grouped down," which is changing the grouping of the batteries so that you're going to be able to conserve your energy much and go much slower. Grouped down, turned the submarine over to the regular submarine crew, said to this Royal Navy officer, "You come into the control, come into the wardroom." And in a half an hour, there was a helicopter there, and he's gone.
Wow.
Interesting thing is, remember I said during the initial phase of this course, we got to know each other?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy used to drive a little sports car. And once when we were heading out to a local pub, I rode with him. And he was the most dangerous driver that I've ever been with. He was driving those narrow roads like there was no tomorrow. And I guess he thought he could drive a submarine that way. And the teacher correctly ascertained that if this guy was in the submarine, he was going to cause some damage either to the people or the submarine. So he sunk them.
Wow.
And yet the guy was pretty good operationally, but he was dangerous.
Mm.
So anyway, when my last operation on the cockfight, and it was the last operation of the whole thing, was doing one of these things where we were landing Royal Marines and then coming to pick them up. So we landed them, and then we went away, and then we came back to pick them up at night. And they were doing everything to me in the control room. They were switching the lights on. They were telling me I didn't have a gyroscope and everything. And I just ignored that.
Mm-hmm.
I said to the engineer, "Engineer, fix it. You fix it." Gave directions for people to do what they were supposed to do, because my job was the operational. I was in charge of the safety, and I had to pick these Royal Navy guys up. And we did. We snatched them with a periscope. We surfaced. They then came back on board. Teacher then said, right, cockfight over. Everybody to the wardroom. We went to the wardroom. The lights were on, and he poured the champagne. Said, congratulations, you've all passed perisher. And he then presented me with a set of Royal Navy dolphins and said, Lloyd, I would be more than pleased for you to command a Royal Navy submarine.
Wow.
And I was very proud.
Yeah.
Later I found out that my friend Arthur, who was my roommate in the first phase, during the second phase, he actually went to his teacher and told him that he couldn't do it anymore.
Oh, no.
He lacked the confidence to do it. So he actually left the course, having sort of bailed out.
Mm-hmm.
I then went back into Faz Lane. We sort of partied it up that night. Phone sent a telegram to my wife. Went down, spent a day or two in Blackpool. Then we went down to Portsmouth, sold the car that I bought, took the train to London, and we flew back. The interesting thing was we were on the airplane and my wife was with me. We managed to get a flip back to Canada. So I was entitled to the flight. She and the children weren't. You know, sometimes there's some spare seats on these Canadian Forces aircraft. So we were flying in the pilot said, we're now at 30,000 feet. And I leaned over to Kathy. I said, you are. I said, I'm at 40,000. And when I come back, we got to Victoria. I phoned retired Captain Cliff Crow, who was then the captain, and said, I'm here. And he says, well, did you pass? I said, of course I did. Nobody from England had told Canada that I had passed the perisher. So I arrived on the West Coast. I knew I was going to be captain of the Rainbow, and nobody had told anybody. So they then made arrangements, put out the posting message, and I took command of the Rainbow. And that was my perisher.
Perfect.
Did training prepare me for real exercises? Certainly. I was more and ready to do anything that I was expected to do as commanding officer of a submarine. In fact, one of the first things I did as captain of Rainbow was I took it to Pearl Harbor, where we participated in RIMPAC 73. And I basically did very, very well in that exercise. I went out and bagged the biggest target in the whole exercise, the USS Kitty Hawk.
Nice.
Got right in, did a perfect attack, and I was able to do an attack and take pictures and everything, and I was also able to let my executive officer and a few of my other officers participate. Yeah, we did extremely well in that exercise, and anything else we did, I was more than prepared. In fact, at that stage, you are probably as operationally capable as you ever are in your whole career.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you go away from perisher, all of the lessons that you're supposed to keep with you for the rest of your career are there, but like everything else, you don't get to practice all the other things that you should be practicing on a regular basis. Like with Rainbow, we did virtually no submarine versus submarine exercises. We did a lot of submarine versus surface ship exercises, which later on, when I was captain of Ojibway and I took her over for workups, the part of the workups that the submarine aced and did very well was submarine against surface ships, because that's where I had all my experience. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the other things, which I'd done none of in Rainbow, I was a little bit rusty, and it was a steeper learning curve during Ojibwe's workouts. So it was, Perisher was a good course.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing, it's like my first year at Royal Military College. Perisher is such a demanding course that it makes virtually everything else you do in life, whether it has to do with the service or not, routine. You know what I mean? It's other people get excited and I don't know about this and that. Christ, when you compare it to what you did during that course and the hours you're expected to work in that, it's a piece of cake. And even in my antique business now, we'll go to do an antique show, and the people running the show haven't quite done what they should do to prepare for it. I see all of the rest of the dealers running around in bloody circles. My wife says, "What are you going to do?" And I take bloody charge. I just go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And people then come to me and say, "What are you doing?" And, because you're the natural leader in the group. Yeah. So it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Perfect, and we're back. So, as I said, what were your initial thoughts and impressions of the Oberon-class submarine?
We have to realize that when I started my submarine service in 1966, the Oberons were brand new.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I was serving in a submarine that was antiquated. The Oberon-class submarines were a follow-on to the Royal Navy Porpoise-class submarines, which were the 1950s design. The Oberons started coming in service in the early 1960s. Canada had three Oberons, Ojibwe, Onondaga, and Okanagan. Ojibwe was commissioned in September 1965. Onondaga commissioned in June 1967 and Okanagan June 1968. Ojibwe was the original Onyx, which was being built for the Royal Navy, but halfway through the building Canada came up in 1963 with a deal with the Royal Navy to get three Oberons. So they took that Onyx and they built it for Canada as the Ojibwe, and then the other two, Onondaga and Okanagan, were built specifically for Canada, and they all three were built in Chatham Dockyard.
Mm-hmm.
The Royal Navy later built their last of their Oberons, which was the Onyx, and the Onyx then was their latest submarine of the Oberon class that they had. The Australians had four Oberons built roughly the same time as Onondaga and Okanagan.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the Brazilians had two and the Chileans had a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not exclusively a Royal Navy and a Canadian submarine. When the Oberons came into service, they were probably as good as any conventional submarine in the world at the time. The only one that probably could compete with them was the American Barbell class, which was a submarine built like a nuclear submarine with a conventional submarine propulsion plan. They had a teardrop hull. The Oberons were deemed to be quieter submarines and better submarine hunters than the Barbell class, where the Barbell, once again, were built for operations in the Pacific. The Oberons were fitted with a good sonar outfit. They had a long-range sonar, which would pick up, depending upon the noise of the target, but pick them up, many, many miles away. They had a short-range attacking sonar. They had a sonar which would detect active sonar transmissions from other, mainly surface ships. And then they had what was called a scanner, a short-range sonar that gave you rapid information on anybody that was close to you making noise, as well as the underwater telephones, which in themselves were useful little sonar sets. You could tell if anybody was close to you because the underwater telephone would pick up the noise. Their electronic countermeasures was not a very good outfit, really. For the time, it gave you basic warning of aircraft, and that's mainly what we use them for, to tell us if aircraft were nearby. But they weren't the most reliable of things. They mainly told you what type of radar it was and gave you a rough idea of how close it was and whether or not he could detect you. The radar we only used for navigation, and it was not the most dependable type of radar. The batteries were good, very dependable, a lot of power. When you put the batteries in series, you could actually get that submarine up to about 18 knots submerged. And they gave you sufficient capacity that if you operated at slow speed, you could go up to a couple of days without having to charge your battery. It was fitted with a snorkel system, which allowed you to charge your batteries while at periscope depth. It had two 16-cylinder big diesel engines from which you could then charge your batteries. The engines were never physically attached to the propellers or the shafts. How the system worked is you had the two engines with generators, electric generators. The engines would generate the electrical power all the time. The electrical power would go from the generators to the battery, and then the power would then go from the battery to the electric motors, which are very quiet, which would then drive the twin propellers. So there's two propellers. So you had two big electric motors there, each with two armatures. So they were very dependable. We never really had any trouble. Maybe on rare occasions did we have trouble with the motors. The main problems that those submarines had in the propulsion side were with the engines. Superchargers failed on several occasions, and they had a lot of trouble with their exhaust valves, and the electrical generators always had trouble with maintaining sufficient insulation.
Okay.
So that's where the Oberon's main failing was in their, in my opinion, was in their engines and their generators. The motors were good. Mm-hmm. The sonar was a good outfit for the time. They were very quiet. If you kept a good noise reduction program, in other words, you went through and made sure no machinery was short-circuited against the hull. In other words, you would go to your trouble to, say, build an air conditioning unit, and you'd put it on rubber mounts and everything, and you would operate it, then that would be fine. But if some klutz left a spanner or something else between the air conditioning unit and the hull, then it would short circuit the whole system. So you had to do rounds and make sure that that in order to keep the boat quiet, that that people didn't do those sort of practices, and that you went through other things to make sure that, because the submarine was quiet, you wanted to keep it that way. You didn't want to make unnecessary noise in the boat. And when you are operating the boat, you would have your normal quiet state. But when you were doing operations against another submarine, or when you didn't want to be detected by surface ships and that, you go to what was called ultra quiet, where you would shut down a hell of a lot of equipment and run your motors at very slow speed. You could run those motors up to a speed of about 8 knots before they cavitated, depending upon your depth. If you're at periscope depth, you cavitated much at a much slower speed than you would cavitate down at 400 feet. Because at 400 feet, there'd be 200 pounds per square inch water pressure down there. So bubbles didn't form as quickly as when you were at periscope depth, when maybe there was only 25 pounds per square inch. So and when you would want to make sure you didn't cavitate. So if you sped up, and then say you decided to change speed from 4 knots to 8 knots, if the motor room put on the speed right away, then there would be a burst and there would be cavitation, which could be picked up by other submarines and surface ships. So you had to train your operators to increase the speed slowly, unless you told them otherwise.
Right.
So by increasing it slowly, there'd be no cavitation. So the Oberons were a good, quiet submarine. And in exercises back in the 60s and early 70s, once the boat was operational and her crew trained up, they consistently performed very well. They absolutely amazed the Americans in the late 60s and early 70s because they were able to operate against submarines like Rainbow and win all the time. And they did extremely well in submarine versus nuclear submarine exercises because they were when the submarine was just operating on its main motor, it's actually quieter than a nuclear boat, a diesel electric boat. When it's operating on its main motors, it can be extremely quiet because they don't make any noise. When it's running its diesel engine, it does. That's its big drawback. So I thought they were good boats. When I was posted to Rainbow, my eyes were open because I came to a submarine which wasn't quiet. It was built in a time in the night, I think Rainbow was built 43, 44, when the noise a submarine made with its engines just didn't matter because there was no sonars out there. So, and they never did anything to improve that situation. So when Rainbow operated its main engines, either snorkeling, which we call snorting, or on the surface, the whole Pacific could hear it. So it meant it was, you know, extremely difficult to operate against aircraft and etc. She couldn't dive as deep. She couldn't go as fast. She didn't have the endurance. She had an extremely competent crew. The crew that the Grilson Rainbow had here on the West Coast in the 60s and the 70s was probably the most technically competent group of people we've ever put to sea in a surface ship or Navy. Yeah, they knew their job. They knew their job very well. And I'm very proud that I'm still associated with a lot of these people. The drawback was the submarine itself was out of date and old and could not really compete under most conditions. And yet, here's an example. I went to sea off of Vancouver Island to participate in an exercise in January. In January, the water conditions are what are called isothermal. The temperature at the surface is the same as it is maybe down at 400 or 500 feet. So those are isothermal, so that when surface ships are operating sonar, they get miles of range on their sonar. And I was operating in an exercise against then our ships, such as Terra Nova and Gatineau and that. And they were holding me out to ranges of 10 miles actively. And because they had ASROC anti-submarine missile system, they were able to conduct attacks. So I got absolutely wiped in that exercise. And when I came back in, the squadron commander, who was a submariner, said to me, Lloyd, he says, you didn't do very well on that exercise. I said, no, I didn't, sir. I said, but, you know, those were the conditions, and you guys held me all the time, and there was nothing I could do about it. I tried my best. 3 weeks later, we're operating down off San Diego. Same ships, same squadron commander, different water conditions. I snuck right into 1,500 yards and attacked those guys. They're booming on their sonar and they got nothing. So we come back into port and I went up to them and I said, "Oh, those are pretty good attacks." Captain, yeah. I said, "What was wrong with you guys?" I said, "She didn't perform very well."
So I had them. But water conditions were very important over Rainbow. She could, she under the right water conditions, she could do those jobs which she was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was designed for attacking surface ships, not submarines. Mm-hmm. She was designed for evading aircraft, which would search visually and with maybe operating radar, not the aircraft at the time, which could lay sonar buoys and track you by sound wherever you were. So, mind you, we were once scheduled, this was when I was XO of Rainbow, the people from 407 Squadron in Comox said, "We want to do a completely free play exercise." And we were up in Kodiak, Alaska. He says, "We want you to sail from Kodiak, Alaska and make it down to Esquimalt.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know where you are. We just know that you're going to leave at roughly this time. You're going to arrive in Esquimalt at roughly this time. And we'll try to find you." And they put all the resources into it.
Mm-hmm.
And we sailed from Kodiak. We went down and we passed fairly close to the Queen Charlotte Islands. And then we then made our way from Queen Charlotte to Juan de Fuca Strait, up Juan de Fuca Strait, into Esquimalt, and phoned 407 Squadron and says, "We're here." They didn't detect us at all.
Wow.
Yeah. And was during that exercise, the Russians, that was back in 1972, that was the year the Russian fleet came down off the west coast, they came off Alaska, down off the west coast of Canada, and went down and up, you know, went fairly close to the Hawaiian Islands. And we were sent out to try to detect them and gather information on them, etc. We never saw them at all. The surface ships, our surface ships, did very well and were managed to track them. But they basically they never came to near any of the areas where we were, because if they had, we would have been able to, I think, gather a bit of information, etc. But Rainbow is a different experience. I value my time there because I, as I once again said, that I work with some extremely competent sailors, guys who I associate with today, and good friends.
I'll ask you to explain what it's like to live and work at sea in a submarine.
That's my wife. Purple. Whenever you talk to people about living and working in submarines, the first thing they come up with, "I couldn't do that because I'm claustrophobic." That never bothered me at all. I've never been afraid of confined spaces. You know, when I was a child, we never lived in a big house. We used to go camping and used to go to camps north of Toronto where you eight boys would be living in a tent and that type of thing. So I was never afraid of confined spaces. And in even in a surface ship, some of the spaces there are confined. And when you go down below in a surface ship into a mess deck, it's not too different than being in a submarine, actually. So the claustrophobic thing never bothered me. I never saw a submariner who was claustrophobic. And I only saw a couple of people in my entire time who went on a submarine and were uncomfortable. One of them was
we took some dependents out on the East Coast, and as soon as the submarine dived, this young woman started screaming.
Mm-hmm.
So we calmed her, etc. And the other one, interesting enough, when I was captain of Rainbow, we took the lieutenant governor of the province to sea with us for a day, he and his wife, and mm-hmm. we sailed from Victoria. We went south into Juan de Fuca Strait. We mm-hmm. dived, had lunch, and did a few exercises mm-hmm. and showed him things. And his wife was completely relaxed.
Mm.
I got the feeling that he was very uncomfortable, perhaps a little bit of claustrophobic, mm-hmm. but he never said anything, or mm. nor did it diminish his interest in what was going on. And you know, when something like that happens, you get, you know, great respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was, when we got back in a week later, I got a letter from him saying, thank you very much, and would you, your wife, and your entire ship's company and their ladies come down to Government House for cocktails and a buffet dinner.
Oh, wow.
So the entire crew of Rainbow and their ladies had a great evening at Government House.
Yeah, if you enjoyed it, then that's good.
Yeah. So that aspect of submarines never bothered me. I really enjoyed the camaraderie of the people
mm-hmm.
in submarines. A lot of fun, a lot of joking going on, a lot of games being played when you're deep.
Mm-hmm.
We used to watch movies when they go deep in afternoons and evenings, and until you've watched a movie in a small cabin or space in a submarine, with all of the comments about what's going on the screen, it's a real experience. We tended very much to support each other and help each other, and very much relied upon each other
mm-hmm.
because you knew that every guy on board that boat had an important job to do, and that if he didn't do it correctly, then it'd be dangerous. I used to use a philosophy to my crew that went something like this, that submarines are safe. They're safe because we know our jobs and we follow procedures, even though we may not know why we're following these procedures. Somebody has said we should do it that way, and we do it that way. We don't say, I think I have a better way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
No, we don't, without, you know, being properly investigated. Submarines become dangerous the moment that we think that they're too safe
mm-hmm.
and that we can then slack off on the job that we're doing. In other words, it's sometimes said as familiarity breeds contempt,
mm-hmm.
that as long as we followed our procedures and had respect for the boat and what it was doing, then we were operating in a safe environment. The moment we lost that respect, mm-hmm. then we're operating a little bit dangerously.
Mm-hmm.
And you find in outside the submarine world a lot of accidents that occur with airplanes and
mm-hmm.
ships, the sinking of the Queen of the North.
Mm, right.
They're all done, those accidents, for the most part, occur because people think that what they're doing is routine and nothing can go wrong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could you be fair to say also that maybe, you know, since submarines are so different because, like, a common perception of a boat, you float, and
mm-hmm.
there's no element underwater, but as soon as you get that element underwater, it's like, oh, you know, it's different.
Well, I always say to people this, that with a submarine, that if something goes wrong, you just blow main ballast and you float to the surface, okay? Unless it's a catastrophic
mm-hmm.
exercise. Whereas in, all of us go in airplanes, and if something goes wrong in an airplane and it's serious, it's a hard landing.
It's a hard landing, yeah.
I also, my feeling towards submarines is I always thought they had
an operational job to do.
Mm-hmm.
That my time before I went in submarines, we used to do a hell of a lot of bullshit jobs, and there was a lot of nonsense going on. Whereas with the submarine, it always had an operational mission, and usually that mission, even though it was an exercise, could be related to something that we might have to do in wartime.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the basic exercises that we do with surface ships and aircraft were training for them, but they were also excellent training for us. And I always felt that when I was in a submarine, particularly in command, that I could do anything that my government wanted me to do,
mm-hmm.
and as long as they, you know, knew the limitations on what a submarine
mm-hmm.
could do. But if they said, we want you to go to so-and-so and conduct a mission and gather information on this, that I could do it. Because
mm-hmm.
that's really, in peacetime, what submarines are about,
mm-hmm.
is being able to conduct covert operations, gather information, and do it without anybody knowing that they've been there and done it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extremely valuable to have that sort of capability. And it's also very important that a country have submarines so that it can, in its waters, so that any other group of people who might want to take advantage of our territorial waters, smuggling drugs, breaking the fishery rules, this type of thing, if they know that we have submarines that can be there and keeping an eye on what's going on, they're less likely to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called what in the force we call it a force multiplier.
Okay.
The force multiplier means that you may not be there, but the mere fact that you could be there
mm-hmm.
allows you to protect the area. And surface ships and air, for the most part, can't do that because somebody can see them all the time. Aircraft do have that capability because, particularly when it's cloudy, people can't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But a submarine, it can patrol a fairly large area gathering information.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Very neat. So I guess we'll move on to the operations portion of the interview. So I was wondering if you'd like to discuss certain operations that you conduct or you were part of during your service.
Okay. Well, I would say that a good 70% of the operations which I conducted during my time in submarines as a junior officer and as command were what I would be called in the ASW training field,
mm-hmm.
in that we would participate in exercise and operations with surface ship aircraft and other submarines, and what we would be doing would be training them and ourselves in the capability of being able to conduct anti-submarine operations and other maritime operations.
Mm-hmm.
The other operations we got involved in from time to time, particularly in the East Coast, we would do a little bit of work in what the fisheries and other people who were in Canadian territorial waters were doing. And in that regard, we would go out, gather sound tapes, take pictures, record voice conversations between fishing boats and that type of stuff. I never got involved in this operation, but remember when the Swiss aircraft crashed?
Mm-hmm.
It was a Canadian submarine that actually located the black box.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
there's a Canadian boat went out and actually located where it was, because the thing, I think, was making noise. He picked it up on sonar, and then he was able to direct the divers in to pick it up. And after I left submarines, during all the time I was in submarines, we were always calling upon the Navy to give us a more operational role.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we were always involved in exercises, but we were always calling upon the Navy to give us a more operational role. I'm proud to say that eventually they listened, and during the 1970s and that, the 70s and 80s, our East Coast Oberons, because we didn't have a submarine on the East Coast, got involved to a much greater extent in fisheries patrol and sovereignty patrols and that type of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And was there, I know you mentioned when you had an interesting patrol in the Pacific Ocean.
No, it actually was in the Atlantic.
Okay.
What happened was I just got back from England, having done the workups with Ojibwe. This was back in the fall of 1975. And we arrived in, and we were due to be alongside for, I think, for a 3 to 4 week maintenance period, because we'd been away for roughly 4 months. And we had sent some people on leave. We'd start dismantling some of the machinery and that, when I got a call from my squadron commander asking me to go up and see him. He said, we're going up to the Admiral's office. We went up to the Admiral's office, and the Admiral said, I've got this problem. He says, there's a Soviet fishing boat up off Labrador. He said, we don't know what it's doing. He says, we think it has the capability to operate a DSRB, you know, a mini sub.
Okay.
And he said he's operating in the vicinity of the ballistic missile warning system lines between Greenland and North America. He says, we think that they may be involved with that. We don't know. He said, I don't have any surface ships. I have aircraft. He says, but says they tend not to do anything with aircraft around, and surface ships, you know, if, as soon as they saw them, they wouldn't be doing anything. He said, do you think you could go up there and find this guy and watch what he's doing? I said, sure. And he says, I want you to sail tomorrow morning. So we went back and we initiated a recall of the crew, got most of them back, fuel and stored and everything, and sailed and worked my way up through the Gulf of St. Lawrence, up the Strait of Belle Isle, bloody cold, and then up that area north of Newfoundland, and we're up there, and working with an aircraft, I was able to locate the ship we're after. I was able to move in on them, get to stay within about a half mile of them, and I watched them for 5 or 6 days, took pictures, recorded sound, recorded every sound he made on his radios and radar, and, you know, had beautiful pictures of what he was doing and that. And then I was then, after so-and-so, I made regular reports, obviously. And then I went back and called up to brief, had to go up and brief the Admiral. And this guy was so keen, he wanted me to say that I got the goods on the guy, that he was operating his mini-sub and all of this. So he said to me, he says, right, Barnes, what was he doing? I said, he was fishing, sir. Fishing? I says, yep. I says, during my entire time there, I can assure you that his mini-sub was never launched once. And that during that entire time he was fishing, and I got pictures of him hauling in his trawls and all kinds of seagulls around him and everything. And the Admiral was pissed off.
Today, I'm convinced that if that guy had have launched his mini sub and I had caught him in the act of doing something like that and brought back the evidence, it would have created some sort of an international incident.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have got promoted and ended up as an admiral. That's the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
As it was. But I got full marks for getting my boat out there and doing the mission in a very professional manner.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they taught us to do during Perisher was what's called an underwater look.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an underwater look is an exercise where you take a submarine you go right underneath the surface ship, and the distance between your periscope and the bottom of this surface ship may be at the most 10 feet.
Wow.
Here or there, and the object is to take pictures of its propellers, of any other underwater things like sonar domes and stuff like that. So we're trained to do that. So I did one during my Perisher, and then I did one with Ojibwe.
Mm.
And I was actually pretty good at it. I took my squadron commander. My squadron commander, when he was captain of a submarine, during workups, he was asked to do an underwater look, and he miscalculated, and he ended up getting in a collision with the surface ship and taking off half of the sail.
Right.
So he came to sea with me when I was doing an underwater look. He was in the control room as I was moving in. It was during the moving in that he screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
I moved in and got in right in. I was watching what was going on, but I was also watching my squadron commander. And he was a pretty cool guy, but he was really nervous because he didn't have control. And he was the guy who, you know, had set up this operation for me. But I could see he was, as I was moving in, really nervous because the last time he did it was a collision. So I moved in, got in position, I think it was HMCS Fraser that I was underneath, and moved in, took some pictures, and called him over. Sir, come on over, have a look at this. He came over to the periscope and looked. And I could see all of the tension go out of his body. Because I said that, and we stayed underneath this guy for about, maybe 10 minutes, taking pictures and making observations. Because all the time you're saying, I see this, and you're talking into a tape recorder, so that you get all the information. And then we broke off. It was fun. Yeah, submarines are trained to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And nuclear submarines are really good at doing it because they have the speed.
Okay.
A surface ship or a conventional boat can only work her way up to maybe 12, 14 knots. So to get underneath the surface ship doing 15 knots is pretty difficult, whereas a nuclear submarine can easily get up to 20 knots and stay at that speed indefinitely. So nuclear submarines are very good at doing that, and they do. The American Navy and the Royal Navy are probably the two best navies in the world at doing that sort of operation.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
And also, I know you mentioned that, trained U.S. Navy SEALs to enter and exit submarines for operations.
Yeah, at the time there was two things. There was the U.S. SEAL teams, and there was the underwater demolition teams. One was Navy and one was Marines. And the Marine group, I think, has since disbanded, and the Navy SEAL team do everything. The group we were working with were from San Diego, from Coronado Island. And we went over, visited where they conducted their training, etc. But on at least three occasions, we took them to sea with us. And what we would do is we would take them out. They'd get all prepared. And before we sailed, we'd take their little boats that they had, and we would lash them to our casing.
Okay.
We would then proceed out into the assigned exercise area, and we'd dive, and then we would proceed to lock these guys out through the escape tower in Rainbow, and we could do two of them at a time. So what they would do is they would go up into the escape tower. We would flood up the tower.
Mm-hmm.
They would then open the outer lid, swim out, and hold on to lines. And what they'd actually do is on their way out, they would then release those boats, which would self-inflate and go to the surface. And then we would then control shutting the hatch again, draining down the escape tower, putting a couple more in the trunk, and we would lock maybe 8 or 10 of them out, and they would then all get into their boat. We'd be going at a very slow speed while we were doing this, almost stopped. And they would then go away and do something. We wouldn't know what they were doing, or they were just simulating a mission anyway. And at an assigned time and assigned place, we'd come back. We would usually pick them up with the periscope, et cetera, or, you know, hear them, because they'd put noisemakers in the water so you could hear them if it were nighttime. We'd then come back, and the boats would be separated with a rope between them. We'd then come through with the periscope, and we'd snag the rope. Then as we moved ahead, the two boats would then come together. And then they would then commence the procedure of coming back in the submarine. They would swim down, wrap on the hull when necessary. We would then go through the procedure of flooding up the escape tower, opening the upper lid, bringing a couple back in, shutting the lid, draining it down. They'd come back in the submarine. Right. I also did a similar exercise with the Royal Navy in 1975 when I was captain of Ojibwe. The Royal Navy was developing a small mini sub for submarine rescue. And that mini sub was designed so that it could hook on to the escape tower of a Royal Navy submarine, nuclear or conventional. And since we were fitted with the same system, they could hook on to our boat. And so they wanted to test this mini sub out. So what we did is we arranged to do that. We sailed from Faslane, which is in the Gairloch up near the Clyde area. We went and we bottomed the submarine. In other words, we slowly put it on. We knew that the bottom was sandy. We slowly put the boat on the bottom, and we sat there. And the mini sub came out, located us, came down, hooked onto our escape tower, and then went through the procedure so that we could open the escape tower, and we transferred people back and forth between our submarine and the sub. Now that is the primary source of submarine rescue now in all NATO navies, in fact most navies of the world. When the Russians lost the Kursk, for some reason they didn't have or weren't ready to conduct that sort of rescue, because if the Kursk had been a Canadian boat or a British boat or an American boat, those sailors wouldn't have died, because there was sufficient time and the expertise was there to rescue the survivors from that submarine. Those Russian submariners died in the submarine when they could have been rescued. I'm convinced of that.
Perfect. So now we're moving into our the covert operations social aspect of our interview.
Well, covert operations, to me, that's what a submarine's all about. I mean, submarines, all the operations they conduct should be covert. Nobody should know about them. So my feeling is, yes, if you've got a submarine, then the majority of its training, etc., should go towards conducting operations where in areas where nobody knows where you're there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the advantage of a submarine. Obviously, there's a lot of training going to what you do once you're in operations, and our submarines must and have to be trained in how to conduct the ultimate war exercise,
mm-hmm.
which is sinking other ships and other submarines.
Mm-hmm.
But covert operations, I think, are natural for submarines, and probably of all the ships in Canadian Navy, the best equipped to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Did I receive any training and on how to safeguard and top secret information? Yes. That begins with your sub-lieutenant's training. When you do your basic courses before you even go to sea, you receive instruction on top secret information, secret, confidential, what the different classifications mean,
mm-hmm.
how each must be handled, and how you handle those sort of books. And most junior officers at some stage in their career are given a job on board a ship, what's called the confidential books officer.
Okay.
And they are responsible, the officer is responsible for the safe custody of all the confidential books, including crypto, mm-hmm. on board a ship or a submarine. He has to, on a regular basis, quarterly, conduct a page-by-page muster of everything from secret and above, confidential. You just conduct a muster on the publication itself and to make sure they're up to date. The confidential book officer also, these books are always being changed.
Okay.
Amendments, handling an amendment, making sure the amendment is put into the book properly, and that afterwards every page in the book is
mm-hmm.
Checked against the list of what's supposed to be. Then there's also the disposal or the destruction of all that information to make sure that it all gets destroyed when it's supposed to be destroyed, etc. Because with respect to particular crypto,
mm-hmm.
there's three types of crypto. There's crypto that is in use, there's crypto that is going to be used, in other words, you've got at a certain date another mm-hmm. book comes into effect, and there's crypto that has been used.
Mm-hmm.
The most sensitive is the crypto that has been used, because if that falls into the wrong person's hands, he's then able to decode everything that you've sent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The next most sensitive is the crypto that's actually in use. The least sensitive is the crypto that's going to be used in the future, because if you lose something that's going to be used 2 months from now,
mm-hmm.
and you tell somebody, I've lost it, then nobody uses it, and it doesn't mean anything other than somebody says, I've had this.
Mm-hmm.
And the type of crypto code is that you wouldn't believe the amount that a ship or a submarine carries in order to be able to conduct operations so that, they're secret.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, and you receive a lot of instruction in that as a junior officer, and in your courses that you take to become a commanding officer, there's instruction, you have examinations on it, and when you're a commanding officer, your responsibility is to make sure that the regulations and instructions for the handling of this stuff are enforced.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And then what were you able to tell your family regarding where you were serving, what we were doing?
Well, with respect to that, it's general rather than specific.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I would sail, say, from my submarine from Victoria, and we were going to be gone for 3 weeks. I'd say, we're sailing, we're going to be doing operations off Vancouver Island for a while, then we're heading down to the San Diego area.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be in San Diego, I think, from so-and-so to so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
We could always give them the dates of when we're going and when we're coming back and when we're going to be in harbor in San Diego. That wasn't confidential. Mm-hmm. Or if we're going to Pearl Harbor, I'd say we're going to be doing exercise RIMPAC,
mm-hmm.
because that was public information. I wouldn't, I would never ever discuss with my family details on what we were doing, mm-hmm. because first of all, it would be sort of boring to them anyway. And secondly, inadvertently, they could get in conversations with the wrong people. Mm-hmm. So you would avoid specifics. You would stick to the general, and
mm-hmm.
We never had any trouble, you know, saying we're off and we're going to sailing for Pearl Harbor to conduct an exercise. I'd never say, oh, and during the exercise, our job is to go out and do this, because
mm-hmm.
It would be of no interest to them, and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back, those things I knew weren't classified. Yeah, I'd say to my wife, geez, I had a good attack mm-hmm. on so-and-so, without giving any specifics at
mm-hmm.
all.
Perfect.
The job I had in Denmark wasn't a Navy job.
Mm-hmm.
It was a NATO job, and I worked at the headquarters of Naval Forces Baltic mm-hmm. Approaches. I was the staff officer of plans for amphibious warfare, so mm-hmm. I got to work with the U.S. Marines, the British Marines, etc. But when we get to cosmic top secret information, I was what was called the Nuclear Weapon Release Procedures Officer on the course. On the staff,
mm-hmm.
and that meant that all of the very, very, very classified messages that came into our headquarters concerning those subjects
mm-hmm.
that I had custody of the publications to be able to take the reference to my bosses and discuss it, and also when we got involved in those type of exercises, and we did get involved in those type of exercises where we would simulate the use of nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
I was able to, I'm not only able, I was the guy who had to
mm-hmm.
explain to the Admiral exactly what a certain message which we received from NATO headquarters said. And in training for that, I did a two-week course on those subjects at a NATO training school in Oberammergau in Bavaria, in Germany. Very, very interesting two-week course, I can assure you.
Mm-hmm.
But it was essential that I had that training. It's the sort of thing that I never discussed anything to do with the job other than the fact that I had the job
mm-hmm.
and roughly what it meant with outside. And when I finished, they told me to forget anything that I ever learned and that I no longer have that clearance.
So mm-hmm.
it was a clearance that I had for a period of 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Cosmic Top Secret Atomic Access.
Oh, wow.
And I could handle it, and you mm-hmm. know, never had any breaches of security.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I remember the general details of it, and the rest I have pretty well forgotten.
And I guess one of our last questions, was there any like news publications regarding submarine operations you're involved in?
Yeah, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that alarms me about the Victoria class submarines we have now is
mm-hmm.
you never read anything good. The media, for the most part, want to know what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to know what the submarine did well. And the Victoria class, because of the difficulties we've had bringing them into service, have not had too many successes. The Corner Brook had a very successful year or so of operations on the East Coast. She operated up off Norway. She operated in the low Arctic. She operated down in the sort of you know, Bermuda, Caribbean areas, and performed extremely well. There was a CBC program which made the submarines look good. Back in my day with Rainbow, that submarine, anything it participated in got positive press. I've got a scrapbook at home that thick of news reports saying Rainbow did this, Rainbow did that. And I got all kinds of, you know, well done messages from admirals and that.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to get a lot of publicity. We took the people from Czech News to sea with us for a day. We took the people from the cable network at the time, it was called Victoria Cable, I think, to sea, and they did some features.
Mm-hmm.
And we took people from McLean's to sea with us.
Oh.
And we used to always get positive information.
Mm-hmm.
There was never any of this negative reporting, mm-hmm. whereas now the media, all they want, particularly with Victoria, is all they're looking for is dirt.
Mm-hmm.
I told, I was at a mess dinner a couple weeks ago with the people from Victoria, but mm-hmm. more importantly, their senior officers. I said, as soon as that submarine's operating, and as soon as you got it going well, I said, you got to do some very positive PR.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you got to take the local press to sea for the day,
mm-hmm.
and show them what the submarine could do and how efficient it is. You've got to make sure that even if you can't have people through, you take small groups of people through, students from a school and that type of thing, and get the press to cover it, that mm-hmm. the high school students from so-and-so went down on board the submarine, and I said maybe even take them to sea for mm-hmm. the day. I said, because it's very important that the people from Victoria see that once this boat's operating, and it soon will be operating,
mm-hmm.
that it's actually doing something. And when it goes up to do its torpedo firings in the Neuse range and that you come back and say they went well and everything went well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, start pinging the positive. We got a lot of press coverage.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once we went down to the Portland Rose Festival in Oregon. It occurs every June.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to have what was called a grapefruit gun on board our submarine, and they had grapefruit guns on mm-hmm. board the surface ships. So we were steaming up there, going up to the Columbia River, and we got in a battle with the surface ship. The difference was is that they would just take ordinary soft grapefruit, they'd put it in a used shell, they'd put a thunder flash in it, and drop the grapefruit in, and it would go off like a mortar. We used to freeze our grapefruit. We had a special little barrel with that we could charge with compressed air,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't send ours like a mortar, we fired ours like a bullet. So we were going up the Columbia River, and we got in this battle with the surface ships, and we would deliberately aim them so, because we were fairly accurate, so mm-hmm. we'd bounce off the funnel and stuff like that. Next day in the Oregonian, which is the Portland newspaper,
mm-hmm.
there's a picture of the Rainbow on the front page. The headline was Sub Wins Battle of Columbia River.
Right on.
Yeah, we used to get a lot of positive
mm-hmm.
press. And my feeling about the media and that is, I feel that the armed forces have a lot to be gained through a positive approach with the media. That you never, ever, 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 when asked a question, say, I can't answer it mm-hmm. because it's confidential. You have an answer that will satisfy the people, and that before any interviews, that you're prepared and know what you're talking about, etc., and that you never, ever
refuse to answer questions. You answer the question, and you never say to them, sorry, that's confidential, sorry, that's secret. Because I don't know whether you watch this on TV. Sometimes they'll want to interview the police or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get some clown there, and every question they ask them is, sorry, I can't answer that, that's confidence. Sorry, I can't answer mm-hmm. that. Oh, sorry, fella. You know, you're supposed to be providing information here. At least say something about the subject, whether or not it's exactly the right. Say something positive, which is going to reflect positively on your forces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do a lot of work with the media here. Whenever any submarine matter comes up, the Kursk, the Chicoutimi incident, and that type of thing, CBC, CTV, and all the local stations phone me, mm-hmm. and I do national interviews and mm-hmm. local interviews. And now, in my position, I can say whatever the hell I want. I'm very careful never to say anything bad against the Navy,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I would not want them to do a disservice.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I can say things that maybe the Navy couldn't say
mm-hmm.
About things that aren't Navy that I don't think are going quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if they said it, they might get in trouble saying it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when I do the interview, they're more than happy that somebody said it.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, that,
no comment.
Line. For example, they may not be able to say that, you know, we should have had this piece of equipment, and the reason we didn't have it is mm-hmm. because of this. I can say, you know, I know this equipment exists, we should have it, and the reason we don't have it is because, you know, probably politically it's not been approved, something mm-hmm. like that. I'm able to criticize politicians, whereas they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The full line, yeah.
I'm retired, but I don't criticize the Navy,
because
mm-hmm. They're my friends there, and mm-hmm. I still want to go to their mess dinners.
Absolutely, yeah, I can't miss those now.
Yeah.
Well, that concludes my formal line of questions. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I enjoyed this, and you know, and as your paper goes along, don't hesitate at all to
mm-hmm.
if you need either clarification or additional information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or pictures of anything.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Because I got records of stuff that was printed in newspapers.
Mm, old and that type of stuff. Good to have. Absolutely.
You know, so I'll look through and anything that I think might be important, I can scan and send.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, I just want to say thanks again, Commander Barnes, for your time today and your service.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Well, good luck with your project and good luck with your career. You ever thought of a naval career?
Yeah, it's crossed my mind a few times, sir.
Yeah. It's fun. I went to Royal Military College when I was 19,
mm-hmm.
and the first year there was hell. And then I arrived in the West Coast and went on board a ship, and we went on a cruise to Alaska, Japan, Midway,
mm-hmm.
Pearl Harbor. When I got back, I was engaged at the time to Kathy. And I said, no, I love this career. I'm going to stick with it. And I had two birthdays that year.
Mm.
Yeah, I turned 20 the day before we went into Midway.
Mm-hmm.
And then because we crossed the international
right
line coming east, I got my birthday a second day. It was
oh.
So I had two July 18th.
July 18th, right on.